Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an extremely talented American fiction writer who was studying science before pivoting to writing. And not just content with writing his own fiction, he also writes about it too. He's currently senior editor of Electric Literature's Recommended Reading and a staff writer at Literary Hub. He recently released his debut book, Real Life, a campus novel that's since gone on to be shortlisted for the 2020 Booker Prize. Brandon Taylor, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Brandon, we just found out about this literally half an hour ago. It was your first book. I can't imagine how you must be feeling.
Well, you know, it's so surreal. And it's, you know, publishing a book is such a difficult and arduous journey that anything that comes after that is just bonus, you know? It's just a real privilege and an honor. And yeah, I mean, it's surreal and really, really wonderful.
But I mean, particularly wonderful for you, because I understand that you grew up in a household where your parents were illiterate.
Yeah, my parents were illiterate, and not just my parents, much of my extended family. And when it came time to, you know, sort of fill out paperwork or do things, I, you know, me and my cousins were the ones who that the adults would turn to, the younger kids who had just learned to read, you know, in kindergarten and first grade. And so we would have to be reading and sounding out these very difficult, you know, legal terms for our parents and stuff like that. So, you know, someone who comes from a family like mine, people don't imagine a bookish future for such a person, and it feels really, yeah, I feel really lucky and fortunate.
Well, tell me about that upbringing on a farm in rural Alabama.
Yeah, so we grew most of our own vegetables, and we had chickens, and at various other times we had various other animals like goats, and there was once a mule who did very little work by the time I came along. He was just sort of a family pet by then. He wasn't much of a working animal. And, you know, we didn't have cable TV, we didn't have internet. We were just living out in the country, as we call it. And, you know, I lived in a community of my extended family. And so everyone was like slightly related in slightly different ways, which was very strange, but it meant that I couldn't get into mischief because they would just call my my family because everyone knew everyone else and everyone was always in everyone's business. And so on the one hand, it felt very restrictive, but on the other hand, I had this kind of idyllic childhood of playing with a network of like 20 or so cousins out in the woods all day and then coming home to have, you know, vegetables we picked from the garden. You know, such a thing now kind of seems, you know, like very upper middle class to sort of start your own garden and to grow your own vegetables. You have to pay through the nose for organic food, but we were sort of getting it just like as a matter of course when I was growing up.
And it sounds like quite a volatile environment in terms of you had all these people kind of talking and laughing and shouting around dinner tables and things.
Yes, people were, it was quite volatile. You know, I wrote in an essay that, you know, my family was a family of like tense silences and slamming doors. People didn't talk except to express anger or frustration or to laugh at a joke. And, you know, we would have these get-togethers over the weekends. Like almost every weekend there was a party in my house, you know, adults playing cards and smoking and drinking and dancing to the fast blues. And then, you know, like clockwork around 10 p.m. a fight would break out, you know. So I grew up seeing people, you know, throwing fists and then the next morning getting up and having a drink together and laughing about all the turmoil from the night before. So it was a very strange childhood, although maybe an ideal one for a writer.
Absolutely. So tell me how you go from that then to university.
I was always really good at school. That was the place where I felt safest. It was the place where I felt like, you know, I fit in. I didn't really fit in at home, but at school I always excelled. And so the teachers were always, you know, telling me that I could, you know, go on to do great things, but I just wanted to play outside and to pretend that I was a Power Ranger. But, you know, when I got to high school, I then got quite serious about going to university and went to a college that was 20 or so minutes away from home, and it was a really small campus. And there I really thrived because I was, for the first time, away from my family, and I was with other people like myself, so like other Black queer people, and I got to just sort of let my hair down and relax for the first time in my life. And I did really, really well at university. And then I decided I would go be a scientist because I'd always done science. You know, if you're like a little Black boy who's good at school as a kid, people are like, oh yes, you should be a scientist. You should be like Ben Carson back before he sort of revealed himself to be a dastardly figure in the last few years. And so I was dead set on being a doctor. And then when I changed my mind about being a doctor in university, I thought I would be a researcher. And I pursued that really seriously, kind of with a single-minded intensity.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up doing a PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Just before we get onto that, I wonder if you could tell me about if you had a kind of coming out process and if that was something that sat well with your family.
You know, I don't know that I ever said the words "I am gay" to my family. I mean, it was a quite conservative and religious family, and we didn't, and even if they weren't conservative or religious, we just like weren't a family that discussed our innermost lives. And so it would have felt strange to tell them anything about myself. But when I got to college and met other Black queer men for the first time in my life, I felt a kind of acceptance that I had been looking for all along, but I hadn't known I was looking for it until these people just sort of accepted me and loved me for who I was and who I am. And so coming out to them and coming out to myself and sort of learning that I could live on my own terms, like that happened in my very late teens, early 20s. And I'm so grateful to those first queer friends I made because they changed my life. And I went from living this very sheltered, very interior life to living out loud and living on my own terms and realizing I didn't have to compromise myself just to get by. And so my coming out process was not so much to my family because I just don't even understand what that conversation would look like, but it was more learning how to live without shame or guilt and how to live on my own terms and in my own way.
And was it something that you'd written about previously? Tell me about how you started writing.
I think writing goes back as far as the signs in some ways now that I'm thinking about it. I was always the one among my cousins who was making up the stories that we would play out with our sticks and rocks in the woods. And so like I was always making up stories and I was always coming up with storylines and playing with action figures and such. And I didn't start really, really writing until college in my sophomore year when a friend of mine encouraged me to take a creative writing class. And my very first creative writing teacher, who sadly passed away just a few days ago, he was just such a kind and generous teacher. And you know, he didn't say, I mean, he said that I had talent, but I think he said that to everyone, but he would just make time for me to come to his office and talk to him about stories. And he just made it seem like a thing I could do. And so I was writing little stories, but I didn't know that like people could be writers. I just didn't know that living writers were a thing that existed. Because, you know, when you're in university, you're reading like Dickens and Jane Austen and Wharton. You're not reading like living writers. You're not reading contemporaries, or at least I wasn't, because I was studying science.
And you're not reading Black gay writers, because there weren't many published.
Certainly not. I mean, James Baldwin is the one that I think we all share. James Baldwin and Elin Harris.
Your book couldn't be further removed, really, from Baldwin.
I mean, I think that that's true. I think that my book is quite divergent from him, though critics seem to want to, they try to shoehorn him in there any way they can. And I'm grateless. I mean, that's a very flattering comparison to me, though I don't think it, you know, has too much teeth. But yeah, I mean, I was always writing little stories, and writing didn't become a serious thing I was doing until I went to graduate school to do science, strangely enough.
Well, tell us about the science degree. So you'd wanted to be a scientist forever. And so you go and you do a PhD. What exactly were you studying?
I was studying stem cell fate decisions in the context of the C. elegans germline. So I was studying how stem cells, which are these cells that can give rise to any cell type within the body, how they maintain that property and what set of molecular mechanisms are at play when they begin to differentiate. And, you know, I wanted to find a cure for Alzheimer's. I don't know how I ended up in a stem cell lab, but I did. And I really loved the work. I really loved the microscopy. I loved the dissections. I loved figuring out the molecular mechanisms. It turned out to be something that I was really suited to, which is just like the single-minded pursuit of a set of questions within a lab context.
And do you think that you can equate that with writing in any way? Is there some kind of the same process involved? Maybe something to do with, I don't know, discovery?
I think that writing and science are very similar. To me, they're both ways of knowing the world and calling the world to you and finding answers. To me, they're just like these knowledge extraction mechanisms. And so to me, they're really not too different. I mean, you know, the sort of doing of it is different sometimes. Although, you know, when you write, you're spending hours and hours, weeks and weeks, months and months on a project. You don't know how it will turn out. And if it fails, you don't know why it failed and you have to sort of pick back through it. And like that also describes science, you know, like that describes many of the experiments I did while I was working in the lab. And so they are quite similar, I find. I think that any kind of creative endeavor is at heart a way of extracting knowledge from the world, or a way of contending with this idea we call mystery. I think it's all coming from a very similar place deep within us.
So there you are, you're a Black queer doctoral student from the South, you're studying science in a predominantly white Midwestern university. Was that difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult in so many ways. You know, there's the difficulty of starting out as a doctoral student. And this is something that I think every doctoral student struggles with, because for the first time you're moving from memorizing facts and figures and regurgitating them to being asked, what do you think? You know, you're having to synthesize knowledge and to create new knowledge. And suddenly your exams are no longer about all of the little details you've memorized, and your exams are instead about what is the architecture of your thought like, and can you think through questions that are open-ended, and can you come up with new methods of inquiry? And that's just a difficult thing to adjust to. So that was difficult. It was also challenging because for the first time in my life, I was among white people who had never seen a Black person before. And I thought that leaving the South, like in America, there's this narrative that the South is very conservative and it's backwards and it's racist and it's horrible, and that the North is like this enlightened, progressive landscape. But what I found was that in the South, like racism, of course, was a thing, but white people in the South, Jeremy O. Harris, the playwright, says, white people in the South know that they're white. And I think that that's true. I think that in the South, everyone kind of knew where they were in terms of the racial hierarchy, and you knew what white people thought of you. But in the Midwest, there was this weird obfuscation about whiteness, and suddenly you weren't allowed to talk about race directly. You weren't allowed to talk about the fact that that person had just done a microaggression to you. So the racism was still present, but you were deprived the tools to talk about it. And so I felt, you know, silenced, and I felt aggressed against, and I, you know, it was really a difficult space to learn how to navigate, because I come from a part of the country where there is a robust racial discourse and where people talk about race quite openly, sometimes in a negative way, but you at least know where you stand with them. And in the Midwest, people would say horrible things to me, and one, not know that they were horrible, or two, if they knew it was horrible, they just like didn't want you to say it was awful. Like, it was just a very strange context to find myself in.
Mm. And it got even more obvious than that, not just sort of microaggressions, but it would seem that perhaps somebody was deliberately targeting you.
Yes, I mean, there are numerous incidents, in fact, where people would do things that felt really targeted. And I remember really vividly one time one of my lab mates said something racist to me, and I went to my thesis advisor, and we were having a conversation in the wake of the Rachel Dolezal fiasco, and I said, while we're on the topic, so-and-so said this thing to me and it was racist. My thesis advisor, who was white, said, oh, Brandon, that's not racism. That's just her personality. And I was like, how can you tell me what is not racist? It's my experience. Like, I know what racism feels like. You can't tell me that this person wasn't doing a thing that felt racist to me. Like, you can't tell me how I feel. And it would happen again and again with this person and many people, in fact. And, you know, after the book came out, some of the people who were doing those things reached out to me and apologized for things that they had sort of looked back on and found racist. And it felt validating, because while it was happening, I felt very gaslit, but it felt validating that they had looked back and realized that they had, in fact, been doing, you know, harmful things all along.
And somebody was sabotaging you. And I mean, that in the end really led to you leaving the program.
Well, I mean, it was that, but that brought many things to a head. I think what you're referring to is I had discovered that someone had designed reagents wrong and had been leading me to believe that they had not, in fact, designed them incorrectly. And when I looked at them, really, really looked at them, it was a kind of mistake that seemed like it was the kind of mistake that a graduate student just like would never make. Like it was just, it seemed entirely unaccidental. And I drew on that experience for the book. I mean, you know, it's fictionalized and it's something quite different when it shows up in the novel, but I wanted to draw on that feeling of how it feels when someone is maybe sabotaging you, but you begin to doubt yourself because people keep telling you that the racism that you feel isn't real, that weird gaslighting feeling of being told again and again that something isn't what it very clearly is, you know? So yeah, there was a moment of where it felt like clear sabotage to me. And it just brought a lot of things into focus that I wasn't very happy there, and that I was tired of having to fight so hard for people to think that I belonged there. I was so tired of having to fight for the feeling of feeling like I belonged. And every time I felt like I reached that plateau, my legs got kicked out from under me and I was just tired of it by the end.
So you decided to leave and to go to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Now, for those who don't know, it's probably the most prestigious one in the United States.
Yeah, it's a really, I think it was the first and it is the most prestigious writing program in the country. Yeah, it's so prestigious that when I told I asked for letters of recommendation and one of my recommenders was like, Brandon, you're only applying to one program. Don't you know it's the most selective one? Like, don't you want some backups? And I was like, no, if I don't get in, it wasn't meant to be and I'll just go back to being a scientist. I'm not going to, it's just gonna be this one program.
That's extraordinary. Now, the book, your debut book, Real Life, came together in an incredibly short time, and it was based on all the experiences that we've just been discussing.
Yeah, I wrote the book in about 5 weeks, a very tense 5 week span. When I was I was working in lab at the time, and I hadn't even decided, I don't think I had even decided that I would go to Iowa, or maybe I had, but I wrote the novel 5 weeks working in lab in these like 1 or 2 hour bursts while I was waiting on experiments to run or incubate. I would sit down at my desk and just hammer out pages and pages. And I should say that like Real Life was the second book I finished. The first book I finished was a short story collection, and that will actually come out as the second book. It's funny how publishing works. But yeah, so Real Life I wrote in 5 weeks right before I left for Iowa. And it was a very intense span of time. And after I finished it, I was just like, I felt like I'd been emptied out. Like I just, you know, your first book or first couple of books takes you your entire life to get that material together and to find out what you're interested in and how you're going to do it. And then suddenly you're just empty and you don't know what's next. And it's really scary.
I mean, did you sit there and think, okay, what shall I write about? I know a campus novel because there's never been one that sort of focuses on a gay Black protagonist. Or was that just something that absolutely came from the lived experience?
Oh no, I think it was almost verbatim what you said. I mean, I didn't want to write a novel. I wanted to be a short story writer, but the agent I had at the time kept asking me to, where was my novel? Where was my novel? And I would keep saying, well, I'm a story writer. Why don't you remember this about me? And so then I decided I would write a novel so that he would get off my case and I would be able to write stories in peace. And so I just, once deciding to write a novel, I did say to myself, what kind of novel should I write? And I said, oh, I know what kind of novel I can write. I can write a campus novel. I love campus novels. And then I think my second thought was almost immediately, except this time it's going to be about a Black gay person, because normally we get like one character shunted off to the side and they don't do anything for the whole course of the book. I'm going to tell this story like from that perspective. And yeah, I mean, I love the genre of the campus novel. I love almost any novel that has anything to do with like a campus or a university or a boarding school. I just wrap myself up in them and just like sink into them. They're so pleasant to me. I love that form. And it was important that I write a book that wouldn't require me to translate my experience into it. And by that, I just mean, whenever I read a book that isn't about like a Black queer person, there is a kind of turbulence. There's a little bit of work you have to do to sort of get yourself into that character. And I love that gap as an artist and as a reader, but you know, sometimes you want to read a book that reflects your sensibility and reflects your experience in the world and doesn't require that little bit of extra work. And I thought, if I can write a book that other people who love this genre can read and feel seen in, then won't that be really wonderful? That's what I really wanted to do.
I saw an interview with you somewhere that said, I didn't write this book for the white gaze, but I wonder if, is one thinking about who's reading it when you're writing it?
I mean, I do think about it, but not in sort of an overdetermined way. I mean, when I write stories, I am very much thinking of this one experience I had when I was trying to write my very, very first stories. And I was very depressed, and my friends took me to a bookstore and they were like, we're gonna buy Brandon a book because that will cheer him up. Books cheer him up, that's how he is. And there are all these gay books I wanted to read because I'd looked them up online, and the store clerk said that they didn't sell them because they were a family store. And I just remember feeling so enraged by that, that stories about Black queer life were seen as not being literature and that they were a family store, so they wouldn't sell these stories. And so I told my friends to take me home, and I wrote my first story in like 2 hours, you know? And so when I sit down to write, I'm always thinking about that experience. I'm thinking about writing for people like myself and like my friends. I'm writing for people who love to read and who want to read something that reflects some part of their experience. And that's the gaze that I am writing for. You know, my biggest fear was that this book would come out and that white reviewers and white readers would really love it, but that Black queer people would read the book and feel like I had done that experience a disservice, or that I had not done a good job of telling the truth, or that I had been too sympathetic to all the wrong people. I wanted to write a book that was truthful and honest, but the metric of that truth and honesty, the one that I was most concerned about, was from Black queer readers. They were the people I was writing to. This book is my love letter to them, and I wanted them to understand that I see them and I love them and I know what it's like to stand where they are. And it was just very, very important for me to get that right. And so, yes, I do think about the reader in some way, but not in a, I don't pull my punches based on what the reader is going to think, but I do write for them, and I feel a sense of responsibility, you know, when I am editing and when I'm writing, like, am I being truthful? Am I being honest? Do I feel like I can look these readers in the eye and say I did everything I could? You know, it's okay if they disagree with me on things, but I don't want them to ever think that I'm being dishonest or morally bankrupt.
It's an incredibly powerful piece of work. And there are so many scenes that jumped out at me. And one is the physical relationship between Wallace, the main protagonist, and Miller. And there is this kind of, I guess, a monologue from Wallace, which is just extraordinary. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, when I set out to write the book, I knew that I wanted the beginning of the book and the end of the book to be these kind of, you know, sliding doors, Rashomon, like I wanted them to sort of mirror each other. And I knew that I wanted the very geographical center of the book to be a break in voice and in register. And I knew that I wanted it to be this like hyper lyric Faulknerian monologue in a block paragraph. I modeled it on the work of a writer whose work is very important to me and who I love as a friend very much, Garth Greenwell. In his book, What Belongs to You, there's this really fantastic meandering section that is a block paragraph. And he has since told me that while I was copying him, he was copying Zabald and Bernhard. And I feel like I'm part of a lineage now. And so I wanted that section of the book to contain all of the things that Wallace couldn't say otherwise or elsewhere. And so I really tried to keep Wallace's backstory off the page as much as I can. So it kind of peeks out at the reader. Flashes of scenes from his past haunt the first four sections of the book, but it's only in that fifth section that the book cracks open, because Wallace is cracking open and allowing himself to be vulnerable and intimate. And, you know, it was the part of the book that was the hardest to write. You know, I wrote the book in 5 weeks, but really, you know, three of those weeks, maybe two or three of those weeks, was not being able to write both leading up to and out of that section. You know, I got to the end of section four really quickly, and then I just panicked and I froze, because if I didn't write that fifth section, the book just wouldn't come together. It wouldn't be complete without it. And so I had all this pressure built up, and I knew that it just needed to be spot on and word perfect. And it required just going to a place that was so dark and so painful and just letting the language roam free. And that's not a space I feel very comfortable in. I'm, as a writer, I'm very controlled, I think. And so letting the language just be wild and free and true to his telling of that story, and letting it be messy and complicated and biblical and recursive and strange. And it was really hard on a sort of emotional and psychic level, yes, but also just technically it was really difficult. And I, you know, that section also is a shift into the first person. And I didn't realize I was shifting into the first person until I had finished the section. And so then I thought, I can either go back and put this in third person and have to rewrite it, or I can leave it. And I just knew that I couldn't, that if I were to try to go back and impose more control over that section, it just wouldn't work and I would be defeated. And so out of fear and self-preservation, I kind of left it as it is. And it exists in the book almost exactly as I wrote it in that first pass. Like, it just, you know, it's like this thing I keep very far away from me. It's so intense and scary.
Well, I mean, it works absolutely beautifully. And a proof of that, of course, is that you've made the shortlist of the Booker Prize, which I don't know if Americans feel this, but certainly here in Britain, we feel it's the most important literary prize in the world, possibly. And ironically, not a single British person, well, somebody who's Scottish is on it, but on the shortlist this time. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of controversy about that. And not only a win for you, but a win for your publisher, Daunt Books, very, very new imprint, small. And this is just fantastic that they've called it right on one of their very first books.
Yeah, I really, you know, they have been so wonderful to work with, and they have loved this book like from the word go. And I feel really, really lucky. I remember when I was deciding between Daunt and another publisher, and, you know, sort of talking through like what each of them brought to the table and what I wanted in a publisher. And I just loved the way they talked about the book. I just loved the way they understood what I was trying to do as an artist and as a writer, and they just so understood what I needed. And, you know, and so I feel like I went with my gut, and they loved the book and they loved me, and they published the book so beautifully, and I just feel really lucky to have had them.
Well, I love the book too, and I'm quite sure that our listeners will. Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Many thanks to Brandon Taylor, and Real Life is published by Daunt Books, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Charlie Filmer-Court and Steph Chungu. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.